Welcome back. We are at episode 301. We breached 300. Joe, are you from a non-disclosed location, or where are you?
Well, I'm in just outside of Barcelona. I'm in Spain. We're traveling, heading God knows where, but we'll end up in France, in the south of France eventually. I'm, you know, it's kind of interesting, you know, like with the modern iPad, you can really get good audible, you know, results. I mean, your voice as I'm experiencing it is like you're right next to me. It's very, very clear. So I'm happy about that. I hope I can be heard well as you can.
Let's hope the internet connection stays up here.
So
what are your impressions of post-Franco Spain?
You know, the really amazing thing is just there's just so many white people.
What?
I was just stunned. We were in Barcelona.
I'm gonna give Barbara Lerner Spector a call. She's got to work.
Yeah, please do. We were in Barcelona last night in the city having dinner, and they have restaurants which are in, you know, basically in the middle of these pedestrian roads that travel different directions throughout the city. Saw hundreds. I mean, it's hard to exaggerate because there's just the whole city comes out in these warm evenings. Certainly thousands, possibly 100,000. It's just overwhelming how many white people there are. It's just kind of like you wonder where they're all coming from. And then there is the categories. You know, I did see gay couples, but very few, a couple. I saw no transgenders. I was looking and just was baffled because particularly after, you know, Biden had brought to our attention the, you know, the volume of this cohort of humanity. And for example, he pointed out the many war heroes that we have who've been transgender. I thought I would see at least one, but didn't see one. And the city had completely recovered from the COVID insanity. I talked to a couple of people about it. There is anger, there's awareness in the general public that there is something wrong with the whole government response. Skepticism keeps creeping up. Spain is having a hard time in some ways financially right now, and that's somewhat related to the Ukrainian sanctions. Energy is difficult to get, it's expensive. I talked to people when I was able to about Ukraine and found no enthusiasm for the war whatsoever. So, you know, Europe is being led off a cliff, but it's not necessarily the case it's going to go off a cliff. We'll see.
Yeah, I think Spain was one of the countries that had the debt crisis, right? One of the pig nations.
Yes.
Was it Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and Spain, right?
Yes, the pigs, yes.
Pigs, and that was the current sort of a predatory lending scheme that Goldman Sachs had set up in the aughts, where they... part of the EU deal, and they lied about their debt to GDP ratio to get them into the euro.
Yeah, that's right. That's how they got into the euro. And so they lied about the debt to GDP ratio to qualify for the union's criteria. But this, of course, was catastrophic because without the correct debt to GDP ratio, they were going to have to ultimately borrow and. You know, then the whole situation in terms of, well, how stable can the euro be when some countries are having to just, you know, create so much of it in terms of, you know, artificial money to paper over, you know, these losses that the government's having. So, you know, the EU is as an organization, it's easy to see when you're in the streets of these countries. It's a stinking, sinking slave ship. Hopefully Europe can just, you know, come at some point, get rid of it, but it's going to be tough. But in any case, it is really catastrophic. You know, the single currency has created all kinds of the potential for debt that is really not, they can't repay it. And, you know, ultimately this weakens the economy, and this is what Spain is experiencing right now.
Yeah, obviously it was absurd to try to tie sort of the Mediterranean economies to like the German economy and the different culture and everything. And these things. And obviously the approach to life in Spain or in Italy or in Greece is very different than the approach that perhaps in Germany, but they tried to force everyone together, you know, ultimately to see what we're seeing today, you know, with Europe being brought to this EU tyranny that's dragging it into a war, you know, that's further eroding, destroying the economic, you know, foundation of Europe, which is Germany, you know, so.
Yeah, and of course the Ukrainian war is entering just what could be the final phase. They have started an offensive.
Yeah, they're blowing dams up now, right?
Yeah, which is, of course, going poorly. And if it collapses, which I would assume it will, then what is left in the pantry to give to it, to give to the Ukraine in terms of weapons and, you know, and soldiers even, and they just, there isn't much to do. And so at that point, what's going to happen? I mean, the Russians could march all the way to Berlin if they wanted to. No one has any weapons to fight them with. So, you know, it's Europe is, of course, in just a very precarious place. I talked to a couple people that I had communicated with before I got here and arranged to meet with them. And they also say that there is still much higher than normal mortality. It's like they estimate it's between 10 and 15%. Above baseline. It's hard to get good numbers because of the, you know, the way they cover things up. But New Zealand has had at least a 25% increase in mortality. Germany is up. All of the birth rates are down. They're not as catastrophic as I thought they would be, but there is clear, you know, negative numbers everywhere. And these are all the result of the vaccine, in my opinion. And so, you know, you have that trap that's been sprung against, the world, but specifically the Europeans. And then the financial side is also, you know, caving in on them. So, you know, it's they need to throw off the yoke of the oppressors, you know.
Yeah. Now, you said there's a lack of or a dearth of rainbow flags in Spain. You're not seeing much of that?
Zero. I mean,
Are you going to go to the U.S. Embassy and register a complaint about this?
I mean, I did, of course.
U.S. State Department should know about this, right?
They should. They have to start maybe even, you know, embargoing or sanctioning.
Spain is a rogue nation.
You know, I did not see a single rainbow flag, and not one. And I was all over. I mean, you know, when we're in these places, we'd like to travel about and just see the stuff. And we didn't see a single one. I saw some gay couples, but they were hard to actually recognize until they would, you know, basically embrace one another, because they don't dress in a flamboyant fashion. Mm-hmm. And it's just odd. I mean, there just is a kind of relaxed decorum here. People aren't really trying to make a political statement. They're just trying to live their lives.
So you're not seeing any dog collars and jock straps?
No, I didn't see any of that. So it's... And Barcelona is known as a risque, kind of highly sexualized place, but it's a very heterosexual place. It is not, I mean, the women are just beautifully dressed up. It's actually quite provocative, and also almost shocking if you're used to
Walmart.
cesspool fentanyl, you know, if you go to Los Angeles and you see, you know, you have the gutter people. I mean, they have what is it, 60, 80,000 homeless. But then you have people like, you know, I spent a lot of time in LA. You have people that are on their way into the gutter. You know what I mean? They're dressed, their manner, they're using drugs. They're still functioning in some way, but they're on their way into the gutter. And then that group affects the fashion of the tranche above them. And it's just the whole, you know, it just looks horrible. You know, when you walk around and see young people with tattoos and a drug life that has debilitated them. You know how they just don't look healthy. Mm-hmm. But this is different. I mean, people are surprisingly fit, and they're just very positive. You know, they exude confidence. So I would say, if you're a family in the U.S. and you're looking for some place to land, you know, because you're trying to get out of the Soros-funded DA zone, I would check out Barcelona. I mean, I know that, you know, you have the EU and all that, but the city itself is, I mean, the the public is really strong. And of course, Catholicism is still very much a force. And even if people are not overtly Catholic, they are influenced by the Catholic culture. Mm-hmm. You know, you can see that. So anyway, it's been very pleasant for me to spend time here. And, you know, I'm a little disappointed in things that are going on in the U.S. and the world, of course.
Of course.
Yeah.
So, well, this week we had interesting developments. One thing is yet another Trump indictment. I think this is under the auspices of the Espionage Act regarding the Presidential Records Act and his dispute with the I think with the National Archives and the Justice Department. We all remember last year when there was that sort of this armed raid into Trump's Mar-a-Lago home, this sort of spectacle or media event where they just grabbed thousands of documents. Warrant was vagued, but this was supposedly an investigation and they're claiming that Trump had illegally absconded with these documents and violating national security. But after all that, apparently the Justice Department has filed indicted him in Florida, district court in Florida. That's where the trial is going to be. So they're trying that again. Of course, he's got the thing up in New York. One thing we know is none of these cases have any real, there's nothing to them. I think they're trying to go with an obstruction of justice charge because there is some dispute with the documents in custody or possession of them after they were subpoenaed. Of course, you would think that in order to go with that, you'd have to have some sort of predicate offense. And of course, Trump as president had ultimate power to declassify anything that he wanted to. He could just more or less wave his hand over, it's declassified. Of course, the irony is that Biden himself and Trump, in his response to the indictment, kind of made this point how Biden was caught with classified documents as vice president, as a former vice president who doesn't have the authority to declassify documents, strewn about in his garage at the Biden 10 Center, you know, completely unsecured and all this. And then you have the Pence issue. He too, apparently it's a common thing. So it at the very least appears to be yet another case of selective prosecution. It's almost like a case of what you call it. It's like, you know, we've heard the term lawfare. That's usually applied to civil law where people use the court system, the civil law, to terrorize, intimidate, and destroy people politically. But that's usually, these are civil cases. You just go after them, you destroy them financially. This seems to be a case of lawfare applied to criminal law. So the Justice Department has been openly weaponized against Trump and his supporters. And of course, Trump is the leading GOP candidate for 2024. Yeah, I think he's above 50%. The closest is DeSantis with like 30%. And so it suggests that they're trying to take him out for 2024. Now, be that with that said, did you catch that Comey interview, former director of FBI?
Yes.
We talked about the retribution presidency. Is this a case of projection?
Well, it's all that they can think of is retribution. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's what they would try to hurl that charge against Trump. But it's incoherent. I don't think any of this will go anywhere. You know, I don't think this leads to any place because the essence of the charge is only coherent if they would be able to prove that Trump did not or classified them basically for fraudulent purposes.
Yes, that's the key of the Espionage Act. It's a World War One law, which is probably unconstitutional.
Exactly.
But nevertheless, you have to prove some sort of nefarious a motive or something.
Yes. Yeah, and then that would be that you see, that would be like, well, it's because he doesn't want his, you know, Stormy Daniels to get out and that information get out, and that would be, you know, affecting the election, and then that would, you know, you could have an obstruction of election process kind of a charge hurled against Trump. But it's been pointed out, well, what if he just didn't want them to get out because he didn't want his wife to know about his relationship with Stormy Daniels? I mean, that would actually technically not be illegal, period. And so, it would, you know, they're going to have to impugn ideas and motives in Trump's mind that no one could ever know or, you know, have any evidence of. And there's always going to be reasonable alternative explanations. It's just a waste of time. It's, as you say, it's lawfare. I mean, this will have the effect of possibly damaging some of Trump's support. I don't know exactly with who. If you look at this, you have to really kind of scratch your head and wonder why they're doing it. It's clearly a political operation. I mean, there's no, you know, law that needs to be enforced here. So they're doing it as a political stunt. And then you have to ask, well, what have they calculated? Because this will only make, I mean, who do they actually think will not vote for Trump because they throw these silly charges at him?
Well, I think it will actually increase support for him.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right.
I think it has in the polls, yeah.
So. And of course, so the thing is just ridiculous. And, you know, it goes nowhere. It's, I would be amazed if it actually ever gets to a trial. I think it'll just stay kind of in what I call like the insult phase, almost indefinitely, like a Hunter Biden laptop or Anthony Weiner laptop. You know,
yes, it'll just stay. It's like this extreme personalization of politics.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And it just shows how decadent the legal system has become, you know, where, you know, all of the offices, DA, the FBI, they're all just compromised at this point. They're all part of the political process. They're not, they have nothing to do with enforcing, you know, any sort of, you know, law for the purpose of protecting the United States.
Yeah, I mean, the judicial system, the criminal justice system, Justice Department has always been heavily politicized and therefore corrupt to a certain degree, varying from administration to administration from time to time. But in the past, there was some sense you had to maintain some sense of professionalism and objectivity and neutrality to maintain legitimacy of the system. It appears that the people in charge are either just insane or reckless, chutzpah, if you will, Merrick Garland,
yeah,
Garfinkel. They simply don't know any limitations to this, and they're becoming reckless with this. And it's an attempt to further polarize politics, but also go after the enemies. It's sort of this exercise of raw power. Perhaps the inner Bolshevik is coming out, and they exercise raw power. They simply don't care how it looks, and for the time being, those that are taken aback by it, who don't like it, simply are deprived direct political power or institutional power to prevent it. So they do it with the thought that, well, we'll secure, we'll fortify the election. We won't have to worry about retribution. Comey saying, fearing a retribution presidency because he'll go after the people that are doing this. Well, if Trump thinks this is a bogus prosecution, Trump would have to go after them. It would be his obligation as the chief law enforcement officer of the country to go after them.
Absolutely.
The same way he was obligated to go after what he believed was election fraud, if that is indeed the case. So this idea of a retribution presidency, it's projection. It's doing the very thing that the Biden administration has been doing since January 2021, particularly with the January 6th incident, you know, spinning the narrative of an insurrection, of a riot, then using using the legal system to go after, you know, just normal people and destroying their lives just to maintain a narrative that they find politically beneficial. I mean, what they did to the Proud Boys, what they've done to the Oath Keepers, this charge of, you know, what was it? It wasn't insurrection. What was it? It was something else.
It was some other trumped up idea.
But it was absurd. I mean, 18 years in prison and these things. And then, of course, we have this spectacle and Comey. Of course, Comey was at the center of the conspiracy, I might add, to unseat the president, delegitimize the president. I mean, first prevent him from getting elected in 2016 with caper that was begun by the Clinton campaign. Clinton, I think at the time, was Secretary of State, working in conjunction with the White House, the CIA, FBI, and foreign intelligence services and or individuals with the Steele Memorandum, and Russians, mind you, to concoct this Russian collusion hoax. And this was fed to the FBI, this false memorandum, which justified obtaining a warrant from the FISA court under false pretenses, which ultimately culminated in the impeachment trial. And of course, we've talked about the Durham report. Don't have to go over that, but it clearly admits this conspiracy, if you will, by the intelligence agencies and the FBI to deny Trump, I guess, his first victory, then also to derail his presidency and also try to impeach him. But then the Durham report says, "Oh well, it was just it was a mistake. It was
right." I follow that. In my opinion, Comey is guilty of like at least four felonies in, in that process. You know, obviously, you know, you can argue one side or the other, but my God, he's just beyond corrupt. You know, you mentioned January 6th. Did you notice that Mike Pence now has declared for the presidency candidate?
Yes. Yes.
That's another really exciting Republican candidate. I mean, he just has such a charisma, but he also has a great issue to run on. Did you catch his actual issue that he's going to like base his campaign on?
Cutting the capital gains tax?
No. It's more exciting. He points out that the U.S. should have done more to help Ukraine. This is the. I'm not kidding. I mean, no. And in fact, he said that if he's president, they'll have all the F-16s that they want. So this is the, this is the pressing need in the United States right now is to give the Ukrainians more 60-year-old technology so they can be shot down faster by the Russian air defense systems. I mean, you just scratch your head and wonder if it isn't all just a, you know, kind of an absurdist script that creates these behaviors. I mean, Pence obviously has no chance of winning anything. He's loathed by everyone in the Republican Party almost, and has no issues of any consequence. So why would he do this? Well, I mean, you know, it's a distraction, I suppose, from the fact that at the moment the Republicans don't have any candidates whatsoever, because, you know, you have DeSantis, but, you know, he really is looking a little too sort of in the grips of the Israeli lobby for my taste at this point. And and then, of course, RFK Jr., did you notice that, you know, his position with Roger Waters?
Before I get to that, I wanted to also mention that this Trump indictment comes at the very time of the news story about this document proving that there was a $5 million payoff to Biden from Burisma, a bribery scandal that the FBI was loath to produce, but they finally produced it under the threat of Christopher Wray, the current FBI director, being held in contempt of Congress. So there's apparently a lot of documentary evidence of, we kind of know this anyway, because the Biden family is very wealthy, and how they get wealthy? Well, by influence peddling, bribery. So it's funny how this would cover, you know, the Trump indictment is there to cover up this, you know, this is the fruit of this congressional investigation into the Biden administration. And of course that covers up the news cycle with sort of this Trump distraction with a bogus case against Trump regarding the Espionage Act. But we have all that. So yeah, it's funny timing that. There was a RFK and Roger Waters. Apparently sent out a tweet that was favorable of Roger Waters, and then he was told that Roger Waters was an anti-Semite, so he immediately threw him under the bus, and then went through was it a parade or something?
Yeah. He just wanted to mea culpa, you know, to point out that, you know, you can't ever be accused of being an anti-Semite. And so he just made a fool of himself. I don't really even know, like, you know, specifically what charges against Waters could hold water if they were some kind of Socratic process that they were put into. You know, it's just,
I think it speaks to his criticism of Israel,
policy
towards the Palestinians, and then he had that concert in Germany when he came out with a totalitarian outfit, and they construed that as being pro-Nazi, and I don't understand.
But my point is how is this, how do you get from there these things to a general position of anti-Semitism? It just, there's no way to get there from these facts. And It's just part of the intimidation that is on top of all Europeans at this point. For RFK to kowtow in that fashion is depressing. I have said, as you know, I don't trust RFK. I mean, he's like, you know, if he's a lifetime actor, as I call these people, he's a good one. You know, he has a great issue with the vaccine. He was certainly, you know, in front of that issue in a correct way. But, you know, he comes from an oligarch family. His father, I think, is well documented to have attended Bohemian Grove, which is not, you know, wholesome. And he, when I've seen him speak, he goes out of his way to bring, to play the Nazi card, which to me is a tell that he's really kind of a subtle mind control force, you know, because, you know, one thing that I've noticed with sort of these lifetime actor characters is that they bring up the Nazi Party and the horrors it created in inappropriate ways. You see what I mean? It doesn't actually fit naturally into the narrative that they're putting out at that time, but they seem to be going out of the way to just keep reinforcing this mind control structure that you know keeps the minds of all Americans in a kind of impotence as far as, you know, not taking their analysis toward who is in charge of our political system to its ultimate conclusion. When you get the Nazi card or the anti-Semitism or Holocaust denier, conspiracy theory, you get these memes hurled against you, or the fear of them being hurled against you, you end up in a cul-de-sac. You end up thinking about, well, or going as far as thinking it's the deep state, it's the military-industrial complex. You know, you come up with some amorphous, impossible to know or control group that at the top of the political system, and that's the end of the analysis. That's where it stops. And even with people who are, you know, good thinkers in many ways, they don't take their political thought into that natural conclusion because these cul-de-sacs are set up and different people lead them into it. They set trust up, and then once they have that, they keep you stymied. You know, I could give many examples of it, but the way that Steve Kirsch and Robert Malone were established as the head of the anti-vax movement at a Brett Weinstein Dark Horse podcast is a great thing to watch if you want to see how they take control of the opposition. I mean, Lenin outlined this as a necessary tool, you know, 100 years ago, so it's not exactly new, but I worry about RFK, and of course I also worry about DeSantis. You know, I think his relationship to the Israeli lobby is incoherent to me. I don't understand why he doesn't try to separate himself, at least to the extent of trying to be independent. You know, trying to show himself as independent of thought. Why do you always have to have all these other areas of independence, like his relationship to the vaccine, for example, and then to this one issue, you know, suddenly all of that disappears and you become a member of the herd. And so with RFK, I'm worried about it, frankly, but that doesn't mean he isn't the best candidate. It's also, you know, like when we had Trump and Biden, the optics were so obvious and severe, you had to root for Trump, right? I mean, what else could you do?
Yeah, it's the choices that they give us, between the dumb or between the D, as they say. Yeah, Robert Kennedy, he Jr. He pulled his support from Roger Waters and pledged his support for Israel on Sunday. He met with Rabbi Shmuley Botich, how you pronounce that. He prays on the Jewish state and joined a pro-Israel march, waving the Israeli flag. So he went overboard on that. Apparently, got to wave the Israeli flag. He pledged his belief in Israel's right to exist. I heard, I think it was E. Michael Jones who commented on this when he heard the news. He said, it's funny, he pledged his belief in Israel's right to exist when Israel didn't believe in the right of his father or his uncle to exist. suggesting the assassinations of both his father and his uncle go back to Israel, and that people have done research in that area, and there's much evidence to suggest that is that ultimately, again, you talk about the JFK assassination, RFK assassination, there's a lot of talk about the military industrial complex and CIA. Again, it's overly mystified, just a bureaucracy, organized crime, but you never really get into details. Michael Collins Piper actually wrote a book called Final Judgment, which actually focused on the John F. Kennedy assassination. Apparently although there was sort of a committee behind his assassination, if you will, involving intelligence agencies. It was particularly James Jesus Angleton, who actually was tied to the Israelis, and it was JFK's opposition to things like the Dimona nuclear plant, Israel's nuclear ambition. He was actually trying to force them to sign the non-proliferation treaty, which they've yet to sign, and also preventing them from obtaining the material to get a nuclear weapon, an atom bomb, that led to his assassination. And of course, people have done research about people involved in the assassination, and I'll briefly go over it, why that is, why the irony is that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. would pledge support for Israel, is the fact that there's evidence that Israeli intelligence was behind the assassination of his father and his uncle. But the idea that, you know, of course, we have Lee Harvey Oswald, who was tied to Clay Shaw. Clay Shaw worked for ran the trademark in Dallas, which was owned by Permadex. Permadex was a cover for Mossad money laundering, owned by, I think, Tibor Rosenbaum, who ran the International Bank Commerce and Credit in Switzerland. And this was a Jewish criminal, sort of like a Maya Lansky type figure, who was running all these illegal arms shipments in that critical area in 1948 to help the Israeli state get established, but also the support for it, which tied in sort of the whole network of Jewish mafiosa in the 1940s and 50s. And this factored into JFK's assassination in 1963. 1968, of course, when his father was assassinated, was the feeling was if RFK becomes president, he's going to reopen the investigation of his brother's assassination. So he had to be taken out. And of course, they set up Sirhan Sirhan, who's a Palestinian Christian. And they claimed somehow this was some sort of Mideastern Islamic terrorism, despite the fact that Sirhan Sirhan was a Christian. And of course, there's problems with both assassinations with ballistics. RFK was shot in the back, and Sirhan Sirhan was in front of him. He was shot in the back at close range, and Sirhan Sirhan was no closer than 3 feet. Witnesses claim that another person had pulled the trigger, the Thane Eugene Caesar, who was a contract security agent there at the Ambassador Hotel, who fled the country right after, was never investigated. There were 12 shots, of course, when Sirhan Sirhan's pistol only held 8. And so a lot of problems with that. But so that's why the irony is rich here. And also, you also have the fact that RFK was trying to get the American Zionist Committee to be registered as a foreign agent, something that has never been yet done. The American Zionist Committee eventually became AIPAC, which has yet to register as a foreign agent.
Right.
You know, so there's a lot of intrigue there. That's why the irony is rich here with him pledging support for Israel. Part of that is a sort of mainstream standard politics. You can't really run. I can see the practicality of it, sort of, because you have to pander at this stage if you're going to be a viable candidate in national politics. It's just the state of where it is. But it does speak to the fact that politicians, the politicians that were given, the mainstream political politicians, still unable to cope with the fundamental question of American politics and also global politics, because it's the American empire, is the sort of the domination or takeover of American politics, of American culture by Jewish power.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting in that I agree with you. I have no problem whatsoever with Kennedy, even to the extent of kowtowing to Jewish special interest groups as part of the political election process, because that's just kissing babies. You know, that doesn't really mean much. It's just, it's the acceptance of their political power and of, you know, and of course the typical insincere political act of being sweet to them and trying to gain their vote, by some kind of, lying, flattery, whatever that you feel that they need. That's
I forget who said it. There's a quote that said something to the effect that being sincere is the key to success, and once you can fake it, you got it made.
Yeah, so. But exactly right. And but the thing is that that's okay. But if you also use that moment to find ways to stop the analytic process of things that have to be uncovered, you've crossed over into propaganda and mind control, and so it's okay to kiss babies, it's okay to be at B'nai B'rith, fundraisers, whatever, but you have to then also say, you know, I have to tell all my Jewish friends that even though I'm, you know, in favor of support for Israel, et cetera, I do feel we have to address the issue of the undemocratic power that Jews have in the United States, because it's just a, you know, it's a real thing. It's not something that is hallucinated. It's not anti-Semitism. It is just a problem within the democracy we have, and it's an issue within the democracy we have. And with that, you know, approach, and I think you could say it with a little more subtlety, but you get the general meaning that would come out of such a position. You wouldn't stop people from thinking. You see, this is what I object to the most: is when their politics and their speeches are, in my opinion, designed to stop thought. And that's really what RFK is doing with his very public kowtowing. And at the same time, not nuancing it with the necessary facts that would also enable people to continue to think about what is really the purpose and what is the the democratic value of the degree of power that Jews have in the United States. It's also the case that a very real and a sincere criticism could be brought toward that power that it's self-interested. You see what I mean? That there is a self-interest that is outside of democracy. That has to be discussed, because there's so many Jewish organizations which are focused on Jewish interest, right? You don't have that phenomena to the degree with Christian or other kinds of groups in the United States. It doesn't exist. So they're virtually alone in our political system with so many powerful organizations which are self-interested, which only have Jewish identity and Jewish interests as their goals. And so, it's a shame that Kennedy, rather than trying to open the door for, you know, better thinking and some honest discussion of these issues, he created, what he did basically was shut the door to any kind of, productive political thinking on the part of the public.
Yeah, it was one thing. You can look at it from a standpoint of sort of pure ethnic politics, power politics, meaning you got to push back, you got to have the organization to push back and make concessions on the other side. There's also a lack of charity here, where a traditional Christian understanding of these things is, to the extent that the Jewish people are mistaken or doing wrong, they need to be corrected for their own good. Meaning, it's the first, one of the main primary acts of, say, spiritual mercy is correcting those who are wrong. So if they're doing something wrong, you correct them. You tell them they're wrong, what they're doing is wrong, and instead of pandering to them constantly. Of course, pandering to them just invites opportunism and more contempt, none of which is in short supply with the Jewish people vis-a-vis the non-Jews, the Goyim. That's one of the things. They don't look at them as having valid, at least organizationally, the powerful Jews don't think that non-Jews have any legitimate claims. They're there as to serve the interest of Jews. That's the outlook of the greater Jewish organizations, at least those who run the Jewish community.
I just want to say that I honestly think that they actually do know that there are legitimate claims. It's just that they're nihilists, and they choose to
well, they're supremacists.
It's supremacists, and the fact that you have legitimate claims is irrelevant, you know, because their structure is that of the lion, their symbol, which is of predator and prey.
And by way of deception, we wage war, yeah.
So you end up with the moral position of a lot of the oligarchs as, really it's just a kind of nihilism.
You have to, in power politics, particularly in the modern era, in order to balance these interests out and maintain some sort of equilibrium that maintains public order and public decency, you have to be able to name the Jew. And that hasn't been done for the past 75 years. You can't name the Jew. And this is this is kind of off track, but this week we had the death of Pat Robertson, 93 years old. He died. And he ran the Christian Coalition. He mobilized politically and was very successful politically, mobilizing evangelical Christian values for a political force. This was, of course, in the wake of the 1960 Cultural War and the Democratic Party become the party of acid amnesty and abortion. A lot of people, the evangelical South, went to the Republican Party. This supported the Republican majority for several decades. Conservative politics in the 80s and 90s, the Christian Coalition. And while they were very successful in mobilizing this stuff, they lost the culture war. Now, why did they lose the culture war? Well, Pat Robertson was a Zionist. And yeah, much of the evangelical right are Zionist. And so they could never win the culture war because they're not willing to name who's ultimately behind things like abortion and gay rights, these, because there was Jewish organizations, but they had to pander to the Jews. They couldn't criticize Jews collectively or as organizations. So they lost that battle. They couldn't take on the reality. What was the reality of Hollywood and the media and advertising? What was Jewish? And you can't name that. A similar thing afflicted the Catholic Church since the 1960s with Nostra Aetate, meaning this idea of open dialogue with the Jews, meaning that they stopped openly criticizing Jews and treating Jews as their elder brothers, spiritual elder brothers, when they're their enemy. So although the Catholic Church and even Christians were fighting the good fight on the cultural front, they couldn't name the enemy, and they have lost because of that. So it's a similar thing with RFK. Again, the very force that probably led to the assassination of his father and uncle, and possibly his cousin, John. That's a whole other story.
You know, Tim,
you can't name it. Can't right. name it. So what are you going to do?
Yeah, well, you could answer this question much better than I can, I think, because you're active in the Christian faith. But when people like Robertson, you name him, you know, like William F. Buckley or, mm-hmm. or any of the Christian Zionists step up and just declare a kind of slavish, love of Israel and proposing, you know, strongly Zionism as a justified and almost a theological force. Why is it that there isn't some Christian scholars that will stand up against these Christian Zionists and say, where in the Gospels are you getting this political position from?
Yeah.
Because if you look at the Gospels, you don't see this anywhere. You see the reverse.
Yeah, it comes out of the Schofield Bible, right? At least the Christian Zionist standpoint.
Tim, I'm sorry, I lost you for a second.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Yeah,
we lost communication. Anyway, let me just wrap up. I'm just asking the question: is where are the Christian scholars who will point out to the Christian Zionists that the position doesn't, you know, flow naturally from any kind of theology you can deduce from the Gospels themselves?
Yeah, and then we got cut off. Did you hear me mention the Schofield Bible?
No, I lost you there. That's what I got lost. Sorry.
Okay. I mean, I think the source of this is, the Schofield Bible that was commissioned by the Jews in the early 20th century to justify Zionism. Samuel Untermeyer and these people. So that was published, and that's sort of been the basis for Christian Zionism in the West, particularly in the United States. A lot of evangelicals are Christian Zionist. And then, of course, you just have the overall rise of Jewish cultural power in the 20th century, culminating, of course, with the end of the Second World War and the narrative that came out of that. So there's a lot of admiration for Israel. So this idea that Israel has to exist to bring on the second coming of Christ and these things. And that's that Jews and particularly Israelis are perfectly willing to exploit that to pursue their interests. But that, and also it's for fear of the Jews, something that's talked about in the gospel. And so you have a lot of, the Catholic Church with Nostra Aetate, this inability to deal with the Jews directly, not only for their theological differences, but also their cultural influence they have, the role as agents of moral subversion of the West. And which is, of course, the Jews themselves write about, which we've often talked about in the Authoritarian Personality and the works of Herbert Marcuse and the, cultural Marxist, the Frankfurt School, which has permeated the entire culture now to the point now, culturally speaking, America, once Protestant, is now broadly Jewish in its outlook. So that's why there's very little criticism, and just the again, for fear of being called anti-Semitic, and not also, you know, we get things like, I think also the moral subversion plays a big part, because operations like Epstein and also compromise play a big part in undermining leadership, Christian leadership, within the Catholic Church, and also with the non-denominational mainline Protestant churches too. Sexual compromise. You talk about the Christian right. I mean, was it? Although I had a lot, you know, I think culturally I had probably a lot to in agreement with Robinson or the Moral Majority. What was his name again? My name fails me.
Jimmy Farrell. I mean,
Falwell. Jerry Falwell.
Falwell. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
I mean, they did a lot of things like Liberty University or Regent University. These are law schools, universities where Christians like might come together and get a good education and build their faith. That's a good thing. Notre Dame ideally was that too, but of course that was destroyed and undermined by the establishment, sold out by Hesburgh, Ted Hesburgh, Father Ted Hesburgh, just so you can get establishment money and support. The Jerry Falwell, I think Menachem Begin gave him an airplane.
Yeah,
that's bought out, right?
Just flat buy. But you know, I'm still surprised. I'm just surprised that. I mean, think about it. There are some. I mean, there's us and E. Michael Jones, you know. But
yes,
it is just surprising me that it doesn't come up more often when you have this, you know, really, in my regard, intellectually perverse would be a way I would describe it, kind of combination of Christian, you know, with Zionism. It just is, it's an odd mix, and it should be contested more often.
Irony is it doesn't get you any like support or loyalty among the Jews. He showed up poll where I think evangelical Christians, they did a poll, what other faiths do you admire the most? And among evangelical Christians, it's Jews. And of course, among Jews, the ones they hate the most are evangelical Christians. it just all it does is earn more contempt. The slavish regard. And so it doesn't get you anywhere. Not only do you lose the culture war, you end up, you don't get any loyalty in return for it, as Donald Trump found out about it in 2020.
Yeah, because they are nihilists, and they feel they can just lie their heads off straight to you. And then whenever the opportunity comes to do something for their self-interest and against yours, they just take it. There's no loyalty whatsoever. E. Michael Jones does a good job of talking about that kind of position that, you know, you can't really, in the context we found ourselves in, you can't really think you're negotiating with a lot of these people. You just can't.
Yeah, E. Michael Jones, he talks about how oftentimes fellow Catholics will throw him under the bus, calling him an anti-Semite, and openly admit they don't want to read his work, but he's an anti-Semite. And they say he's an anti-Semite because they go to Google, and Google says he's an anti-Semite. Of course, Google takes you to the ADL website. So why are Catholics relying on the ADL to tell them who they can and cannot support? Because it's fear. It's, again, ultimately goes back to fear of the Jews. And also, they don't want to be cut off from the funding that inevitably the Jewish power controls, the money spigots.
Yeah. No.
And they don't want to be called bad names.
They're afraid.
Yeah.
And they've been made, they've been intimidated. And one of the reasons why I'd like to see more, you know, zealot Christian scholars take up the gospel's position vis-a-vis Zionism is because I think it would help unravel the intimidation. You know, the problem we find ourselves in is primarily psychological. We've just been structured to think in a way that is negative to ourselves, right?
Yeah, you internalize the commands of our oppressors, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the authoritarian personality was really that whole march through the culture was designed, if you think about it, just to create that exact thing, you know, where our minds have been restructured so that our self-interests have been superseded and another group is occupying the territory of our consciousness, you know.
Well, another thing is a lot of decent people, and I see this a lot, I talk to people, I go to church or events and just talk casually with people, and they'll lament what's going on. They're confused and they don't like, and they're angry with the culture, but they don't, have the grammar to understand why it's happening, who's doing it. And of course, you have to call out the organizations. And to do that, you have to confront the fundamental question here, which is Jewish power. They're behind it. That's, you know, so everyone comes off looking as sort of like an Archie Bunker, right? That's what Norman Lear was creating, this sort of this ignorant conservative who didn't know, he just didn't know what was going on around him. He didn't like it, but he couldn't articulate a position. He just came across as an ignorant bigot. And that was the intention there. And then most people who watch that show identify with Archie Bunker, but they realize if they identify with Archie Bunker, they come across looking like an ignorant bigot, because that's the whole point of Norman Lear's TV show.
Exactly.
You feel that way.
It's just very subtle. It's not just propaganda, but it's actually subtle mind control.
And it ended with Archie Bunker, the character, being Judaized, coming out for gay rights and abortion, becoming liberal. Watch how that show finally ended. Because the early parts of it, most people actually related to Archie Bunker. But the show Judaized him. And that's the importance of propaganda, understanding, being able to name the structure, the people behind it, the organization, the history, and knowing what the American Jewish Committee is, what the authoritarian personality is, the Frankfurt School and these things, and this kind of effort to undermine, morally subvert the country, the culture, to render it malleable and easy to conquer, which evidently we are. So we have become. So
yeah, and that's why, even though not to toot our horn, but we are at least part of the process of unraveling that, and just discussing the issues and how we've got here historically and what has led us to this position. Mm-hmm. Just discussing it. It helps everyone, helps me, I think it helps anyone who listens to us, just be more agile mentally, so you don't just end up like Archie Bunker with, negative emotions. You don't like the transgender agenda, which is top down and artificial, but you're not in a position somehow to articulate, well, who actually is both behind it and benefiting from it. Mm-hmm. You don't talk about it in terms of its malevolence, its cultural malevolence. And if you don't have those things as concepts, how can you really be coherent about it? All you end up is just complaining. You just complain of, the gee whiz, the Target stores are selling grooming costumes for five-year-olds, you have to go beyond that. And again, it just goes to the point I've made so many times, just analytically, the purpose is to continue thinking. You can't just, come and think, well, it's just the country is disgusting, or, the military industrial complex, or the CIA. These are just concepts that are cul-de-sacs. Got to keep going, got to keep thinking, who is actually, creating this? And I thought one of the most really significant bits we've ever done was just the show where we named the organizations that were promoting transgender, and that they were Jewish organizations. Mm-hmm. And so then you have the grammar, when who what the organizations are, to be able to think about, well, it isn't just culturally degenerate, it's not just like the country's going to hell in a handbasket or some kind of expression like that. It's a plan. It's a plan that has malevolence and details and organization. And if you don't think about it that way, then what can you do about it, right? You have to be able to talk about what's going on in order to change anything.
Well, here's an example. If you have any other organization, any other group that organizes and networks the way the Jews do, they're condemned as either, sexist, old boys network, racist. But no one ever condemns Jewish networking or nepotism. It's the Jewish circular economy. It's the way Jews are, and they're very smart and they're organized well. Well, if any of your groups that are organized under those same terms, they're condemned. In fact, a law is applied to them. There's antitrust law that's applied to them, anti-discrimination law that's applied to them. And so that's one advantage that they have, is they're able to do the very thing which other groups, even if they're so inclined, cannot do, because the law is used against them. And that's weaponized against them to prevent them from doing that. And if you do apply the same law, the same standards to Jewish people, you are accused of anti-Semitism, courtesy of the ADL.
It's really interesting. One thing that I'm fascinated by is how the oligarchs, the Jewish oligarchs, manipulate the common Jew. I really think the common Jewish person is just as manipulated or more so than the European. I don't think if they articulated the
That's what the Talmud's for, isn't it?
Well, pretty much.
You're missing to do the very things that support Jewish power. Good example, this whole Talmudic strategy behind the whole national strategy to counter anti-Semitism. It's there. It's going to actually increase what they describe as anti-Semitism, because it's going to increase discussions and criticism of Jewish power, which by the ADL's definition is anti-Semitism, which justifies even more initiatives to counter anti-Semitism.
Right. Yeah.
The Jewish circular hate economy, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the strategy. That's the Talmud. That's the strategy, is that's how you maintain group cohesion. And I was talking to a sibling about this, and he was saying, well, what you're saying is Jews are just better than you. They're more competitive. I says, well, no, they lie and cheat better than I do, and I'm willing to give them that. But I'm not saying all of them. I'm saying the people that get to the top, the oligarchs, the billionaires, these are very slick criminal people.
Yeah, and they're able to
use their unique Jewish identity to shield themselves from criticism, from the scrutiny of law enforcement, at the same time organize in a way that enables them to outmaneuver other groups or who are denied that very identity. So that there's ethnic warfare going on here. One group can have an army, can have a war chest. The other group is denied any organization, any identity to counter it. That's why you have Jewish supremacy.
But notice that this is why they have to always use these secret organizations, secret, because they can never bring the actual intent of their plan to not only to the public, but to their own people. I think because if they actually, you know, if the Bohemian Grove or the Skull and Bones organization, or particularly Freemasonry, mm-hmm. actually identified, well, this is who we are, this is where we're going, this is what we want to do, they would probably be, you know, tar and feathered, you know. So secrecy has always been part of this project. And that's really what has to be destroyed, is the secrecy. We have to destroy the secrecy, because the secrecy is what enables them to both to be nihilistic, right, and then still be able to intimidate people to from actually analyzing them for their behavior. You know, they find ways to you know avoid all of that, but they never are called on the malevolence, because it occurs, you know, behind closed doors and a need to know situation, however they structure.
Well, I think with Jews, it's obfuscation and narrative control. And what you do, you wouldn't get like an Al Capone or Sam Giancana or a Bonanno family foundation that launders the family's reputation then it gives to Italian or Sicilian charities, which enhance Sicilian and Italian power within the host culture. With Jews, what they do is certain Jews, now Marlansky wasn't as successful with this, but certainly Louis Rosenstiel was, and the Brofmans is they launder their reputation, become legitimate, and they establish foundations, and the way they exercise Jewish philanthropy is always to increase Jewish power. Jewish elite. It's never there to help anyone. All their philanthropy, you know, they'll give to some Jewish cause which promotes Jewish interest or at least promotes the Jewish narrative. I give the Jewish charities. Oh, that's kind of you. We build Holocaust museums, make everyone feel guilty. Oh, that's great. That's great philanthropy. You know, or we'll give medical charities which support big farm, which are owned by Jews, like Pfizer. So it's a Jewish circular. You know, so it's they. I think what's it called? It's called Hasbara, where they control the narrative. That's the broad Jewish strategy to control perceptions of reality. With Hollywood and I think of the five or six major advertising companies, they're all Jewish owned, and they coordinate. They control the narrative. Same with Hollywood, and with the ADL, with public discourse and these things. They act like a mafia. Hollywood was like Norman Lear was part of the Hollywood mafia, Malibu mafia. Which was projecting under the guise of entertainment their worldview, and they were subversive acting under the guise of Hollywood and receiving the patronage of America, in America simply paying for its own destruction by letting them have that position of high cultural power in our country.
Yeah, charity has been one of the camouflages that they've used really effectively. Look at Bill Gates as just a, you know, almost comical example of that.
Well, I'm not exclusively Jewish. Rockefellers and Gates are a good example of it. Yes, true. Yes.
Well, but I think the oligarchs in general, and since we don't really know the ethnic identity of these people, and in fact they all lie their heads off, we have to assume they could actually be converso, right?
I mean, that's true too. Yes.
You know, so you have to at least consider. But nevertheless, they expose themselves always with the big charities. It just is. It just seems to me just always the case that whenever
George Soros is almost common knowledge now.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and he's actually become an adjective. The Soros DA is something you can actually talk about.
Yes.
To people, you know. Just as to digress, I was with people who were from San Francisco, and you know, very left wing. Classically minded people worried about Arab terrorism, you know, don't want to talk about 9/11 and as the physics of it, you know, that kind of a consciousness. But they sure as heck knew about a Soros DA. They understood, and they really were upset about it because, well, they'd lost property value.
Well, there you go.
Their self-interest was demolished by a Soros DA and a process of the Soros DA. And they've looked around and seen that this is going on everywhere. So, you know, that is one useful thing, is that we have a term now that you know, kind of cuts across the foundational camouflage that they use with charity.
What needs to be done, instead of paying tribute to Israel and calling Jews their elder brother and worrying about being called an anti-Semite, we need to call for an investigation of the Justice Department. That's not going to happen under Merrick Garland. Maybe at the state level you could do this. Ideally, our government is sovereign representatives. There should be a RICO case brought against the Open Society Foundation and George Soros for funding criminal operations, meaning funding for riots and paying for these groups to go out and commit violence intentionally. And an investigation, I think, would produce a lot if it was.
Of course. I mean, he should be investigated under RICO statutes.
Yes. I mean, and anyone connected. RICO is anyone connected to it.
Absolutely. It's just completely transparent. I mean, where do the bricks come from that the BLM demonstrators threw? I mean, just what is known is enough to create a case that should be brought, you know, to justice, you know? And if that was the case, if some smart and strong DA went forward, you know, he'd face headwinds from, well, everyone. But nevertheless, just think of the value to the public from the disclosure.
Yeah.
Just think about it.
Well, an analog to this, or a comparison would be something on the lines of, say, 1930s, congressional hearings into the war profiteers, or the 1950 Reese Committee hearings into the role and power of the great foundations in undermining the American way of life, as they said back then. Something, again, America has been dissolved. I don't think it even has the sovereignty to even do this anymore. It's not the Congress, but they look into these organizations. Just because they're Jewish doesn't mean they should be denied scrutiny. And I would argue that the reality situation is, because they're Jewish, they need special scrutiny. I know it's not polite to say that.
Yeah.
It's a liberal. If I say at a barbecue party, at a barbecue or a party mixed gathering, it's going to offend a lot of people. But it's because they identify as Jewish organizations, and the reality of Zionism in a foreign state, and the fact they're all linked to Israel. Many Jews are saying them, they're Zionist agents, they identify as that we need a special scrutiny for this. It's a situation, it's a reality they've created with their agitation and their activism.
I'm gonna give you at least what I would hope is, you know, something positive to think about for the future, in that, you know, just the phenomena of the independent, because of the response to Tucker Carlson's podcast, he got 100 million views. 100 million. Now, you know, I know a lot of them are not clear-minded and come to for the wrong reason, but when you compare Carlson's, you know, results on the internet to, say, for example, CNN's attempt to go online, CNN, which they spent a fortune on, and I think they got like 500,000, you know, viewers after a couple of months. I mean, so the independent media is swallowing the legacy media. And with the independent media, if you could, and now, of course, I think Carlson is controlled, but the people who are coming to listen to him are not.
Yeah.
They are representing the force that can create their own Reese Committee. We don't need no stinking Reese Committee. We can actually do this on our own, you know, using our own analytic skills and our communication now that brings 100 million people to a single point, you know? I mean,
but at some point that consciousness has to be expressed politically, and you're going to need
100%
an army to arrest people.
Well, of course, but that will follow naturally.
Yeah.
If you get 100 million people listening to shows like ours every week, you're only a few months away from real political change.
Well, that's what they're sort of frightened of. That's what this whole anti-Semitism hysteria is about.
They know that truth will out, to use an expression, and that when you see the focus, and because you see, the thing about the Carlson is not Carlson. It's the people who come. It's the people who, you know, they know something is wrong. They're on the analytic path. That's why they're there. They want.
Well, they get the sense that Carlson is going to provide them some substance,
some real news, some information about the world, because they know they're not getting it anywhere else. But they have skepticism, certainly of the legacy media, and so they are on the analytic path. They're actually moving towards something, you know, like that could be created if you had a real Reese Committee or a real Church Committee into, you know, the oligarch power and how they've subverted the whole political class. But anyway, do you see what I mean? It's really heartening to see that. It's heartening to see the volume of response, because it isn't Carlson, it's the people that are coming to listen to him. And if you can get enough articulation, which is to say enough good podcasts going on, you know, we could have 100 million people just listening to the truth and trying to work through the analytic path, the Socratic method, to find out what in the hell is the identity of the group that is running the government. That could happen.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what Carlson does now that he's unleashed, to see how far he will go. I heard an interesting analogy describing this by E. Michael Jones just last night. He said with Tucker Carlson's show, how a lot of it was standard Tucker Carlson fare with, you're talking about Ukraine. Of course, he caught the ire of the ADL again because he referred to Zelensky as rat-faced, which is an anti-Semitic
I love character. That. Yeah, called Zelensky.
And they go off on it. And the idea that now Tucker, I mean, did the most anyone can do given the confines of Fox News and, you know, cable news. And E. Michael Jones said that it's almost as if it's like a killer whale at a SeaWorld. They'll put them in a tank. You take that whale and you put him in the ocean, degree circumference, despite the fact he has all ocean because he's so used to that circumference. The question is, if Tucker is now he's free out at sea, will he swim a wider circumference now that he's free?
Yeah, I think he's a cul-de-sac, and I don't think he's going to go outside of this circumference. In fact, I think that if you notice, he in his first show, he talked about the, covered up evidence for UFO.
Yes, citing a U.S. Air Force intelligence officer. Yeah.
That reminded me of David Icke's claim about the reptilian DNA and the oligarch families. I mean, it's a tell of a controlled agent in that he provides the method by which he can be restrained, you see, at the very beginning, because the lizard people claim that Ike's gave always has been used whenever they need a way to rein him in. They just point out that he's nuts. And Tucker, in the first show, I mean, he just didn't need to go into something so stupid and irrelevant to the political crisis we're facing. And I just thought that's very subtly a way to, move him and to just start to brand him as in a way that can be used whenever he actually becomes a figurehead of a movement that's moving towards some clarity. You know, then they can rein it all in. That's how I interpreted that. I didn't like it at all. And I was actually thought that this is probably what we're going to get out of Carlson in the long run, is just like E. Michael Jones says, a, a killer whale that swims in a small circle.
So only time will tell, I suppose.
Yes, sir.
So wish him the best and hope he does the best work he can. That's all.
Absolutely. And we hope, I hope he, that the attendance goes up every week.
Yeah, because the extent that he stimulates thought.
Yeah.
Let the people take it and run with it. Yeah.
Yep.
So, okay, Joe, I'll let you enjoy the old world.
I'm sitting here staring out at the Mediterranean. I'm about to wander out and join all these lovely white people that are rolling around on the beach. I hope no one thinks I'm racist.
I understand it's okay to be white. I
need that tonight. All right.
Well, I think it's okay to be white, it's okay to be around white people too. So
that's my opinion. All right, brother. Talk to you
soon. Take care. Have fun. Bye-bye.